Good evening and welcome to the August 16, 2021 Chelan County Public Utility District Commission meeting. Today we will meet in both the study and business session, a study session this morning, and if we wrap up early, we may do some of the business this morning, but we'll have to wait and see. I'd like to welcome you all. Today we have four commissioners present. Commissioner McKenna could not be with us, and we have Rebecca Newman, clerk of the board, Eric Walquist, our attorney. Steve Wright is in the meeting, but actually today, since he is remotely checking in, Sean Smith will be conducting the business in the boardroom. Since we are meeting primarily remotely, virtually, because of the COVID pandemic, we would normally ask people to silence their cell phones while in the boardroom, but I would also today say, if you're speaking and you have a phone on you, it might ring when you're speaking, so you still need to silence your cell phone. And when you're not speaking, would ask that you mute yourself, so that would minimize the potential distraction of anything going on from your end in that remote capacity. I do understand that we may have some visitors on the line today, and would like to let everybody that's in the audience that's not utility-oriented, or those also that are in the utility, that we will have at the end of our morning session opportunity for public input and public comment about items that are not on the agenda. If there's any item on the agenda that anybody that's on the call wishes to speak to, we would ask that they provide us that information, and so we can potentially invite you to speak to an item on the agenda. At this time, is there anybody on the call that wants to speak to any item on the agenda? Hearing none, to get us going, I would like to ask Neil Naruto. Pardon me, Neil, I'm going to try it again. We talked about this just before and Neil Neil Narutsos. Naruto. I didn't want to introduce you as a woman, Neil. You can share our joke with the crowd and do our
thank you, Commissioner Smith. Thank you for having me this morning. It's a pleasure to open up the meeting with all of you. If you could join me with the flag salute. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Well, today I want to talk about a couple things. Again, I'm Communications Manager Ian Leroux, so I want to talk about the long-term care insurance that's being mandated by the state that's coming up in January. Our HR department's done a great job of getting word out to our employees, but I wanted to reinforce some of those communications and provide a little advice. I'm not here to provide advice. I'm here to provide resources. So this is a personal choice you make when you look at your long-term care insurance. I know many of us who've had family members in long-term care. It can be a really emotional issue. I had two family members this last year that were in long-term care, and you know, just the emotional side of it alone is a lot for a family to go through. So anything we can do to cover the insurance side of things so that we have less to think about when these issues come up is going to make things easier for all of us. So according to Washington State, 7 in 10 of us will have some long-term care needs as we age. The state estimates it can cost annually up to $66,000 for 20 to 40 hours of in-home care. That's on the high side. And up to $131,000 for facility care. So you can see this gets very expensive. If people have other needs, dementia, other things, it obviously adds to the cost. So again, something that can be very costly for all of us and our families. And as you know, without adequate insurance, people are forced in many cases to spend down their lifetime savings. So it's really an important piece to have this in place. Fortunately, there are some great resources, and that's mainly what I wanted to talk about today. If we all do our homework about what fits our own personal situation, we'll be better suited as these things come up as we age. One great resource is our SharePoint page online for employees. There's a benefits page that's being updated. There's some excellent resources there with links to different sites, background on both the state program and the PD program, so you can take a comparison, look at both, and see what is best for you. And then some FAQs, if I didn't mention those. Some other great resources, if you haven't looked at them already, is the Unum site. This is the district's long-term care provider, and that's UNUM, Unum. The second one I'd refer you to is the Washington Cares Fund. This is the state site, and you can search, just Google both of these sites by name, Unum site and the Washington Cares Fund website. And then I'd also refer you to the federal website for resources, which is longtermcare.gov. So those are all three great sites. If you go on our SharePoint page, you'll see that those there are links to those and other resources on that page. So, and then finally, I turn to our HR benefits team. They're fantastic. I've been involved in some of this process in terms of trying to help explain this to employees. It's a it's not an easy set of guidelines to, when you look at all the programs, but they've done a fantastic job of explaining it to people. And take a look at the FAQs if you get a chance to do your research. So with that, I'll turn it over back to Commissioner Smith. And again, thank you for having me this morning.
Commissioner Smith?
I apologize. I turned myself off rather than back on. So, Neil, I do want to thank you for this most timely safety minute. I think every employee got a something from the PUD in the mail and looked at it and said, what is this? What does it mean to me? And who do I need to talk to? And it's incredibly timely. So thank you so much. And I promise not to massacre your name again. And maybe it'll be just by introducing you as Neil. I don't know. So that, but it's Naruto. So I got the masculine on it. So that's great. So anyway, thank you so much. Any commissioners? Any other comments, from commissioners?
Well, Neil, I also would like to comment and thank you for your presentation. This is timely, and it's an issue that is being forced upon each employee to look at personally and take into account their personal desires and issues going forward, simply because the state is going to mandate some long-term health care and an extraction of some money from your paycheck to do it. So it's definitely very timely, gives everyone enough time to take a look and see what's right for them. So good topic. Thank you.
Any other commissioner comments? So thank you again so much, Neil. Now, item two on our agenda is the approval of the agenda. And is there a desire? I don't believe there's any items on the consent agenda that would necessarily be moved. Any changes needed on the agenda, commissioners? Hearing none, we will it'll stand approved as presented to us, and we'll move to item three, and I'll hand it off to Sean Smith to talk about our CPO winner recognition.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think Steve wants to talk about this one because it's such an amazing story with Evan and Smith and Anthony Ibarra helping out a person in need and potentially saving his life. So we wanted to get Steve on the phone because we thought this was very important that you heard from him too.
Yeah, thank you, commissioners. I am not there today. I'm meeting with legislators from the Pacific Northwest and Northwest Canada. But this is such a great CPO. I really wanted to join you today to talk a little bit about it. So Evan Smith and Anthony Ibarra are employees of ours who found themselves in a very difficult situation where someone was identified to them as potentially in a life-threatening situation. And I should probably take out the word potentially. They were in a life-threatening situation. And they had to step to the plate and react. And we all wonder what we would do in a moment like this. Would we actually take the action? And they did. And there is a very high probability that they saved this individual's life. So this is probably the best example of taking personal accountability that we have run into since we began the CPO award program way back when. And I just felt it was so important. I wanted to take the opportunity to introduce Evan Smith and Anthony Ibarra to you. I believe Evan is in the room. I'm not sure whether
he is.
Okay. I'm not sure about Anthony, whether he's online or not, but I would ask Evan presented to the senior team last week and just did a great job explaining the situation and what he and Anthony were able to do. I'd like to have him come up and discuss with the board the situation that he was confronted with. Evan, can I turn it over to you?
Yep. So just a quick, preview. It was a Sunday evening. Tony and I were working down by the boat launch near Pybus Market. Someone on a bike rode by, saying, "Hey, someone is overdosing." Further down the trail, so I got in my cart and drove down, kind of apprehensively, like, "All right, is this guy actually telling the truth or not?" And as I approached the vehicle, a woman was frantically screaming, kind of slapping the guy in the face, trying to get him to awaken. And as I drove up, I noticed a needle on the ground. So I was like, okay, this is probably some sort of, it is an overdose. So I called 911 and put the 911 dispatcher on speaker. So I was able to hear her as she gave me instructions to pull the gentleman out of the vehicle on his back, laid him down on the pavement, and then I proceeded to start chest compressions on him. I did that. I don't know how long I did it for, until a police officer arrived. Once he arrived, he and I together continued chest compressions. And at one point, we got an audible grunt, kind of type of grunt out of him. So we knew what we were doing was working. And then about, seemed like 5-10 minutes later, about 15 to 20 Chelan County firefighters and Ballard ambulance paramedics arrived. And then they began the air breathing with the bag. And I believe they also gave him some sort of shot of adrenaline, which brought him back to consciousness as they put him back into the ambulance.
Great story. Amazing. Commissioners, did you have anything to add?
Hi, this is Ann Condon. Just congratulations. Steve said it, and it's true. I think we all, at least I definitely wonder if under those kind of conditions, emergency situation like that, whether I'd be able to perform, and I'm not sure I would. So you're young and you're, obviously knowledgeable and dedicated and great work. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm sitting here thinking that this story somewhat leaves me without words. I think all of us, it's an incredible, somber experience. What you managed, the two of you managed to do to save another person's life. I mean, there's nothing of greater importance that you could have done. So I just say thank you so much for doing what you did.
Thank you.
I would, this is Dennis, I would like to, thank both of you for taking personal responsibility you know, our public depends on us. You know, someone basically flagged you down, got your attention. You went to the scene. Another person was expressing that need. The protocol you followed resulted in someone's life being saved, being preserved. There's just a whole chain, a series of thinking and action that exemplifies your character in action. And I just applaud you and thank you very much. And, you know, again, thanks for representing the organization in our best move forward, and that's our employees. So, gentlemen, thanks for doing what you did. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And I just wanted to add, I really appreciated that the district puts on first aid CPR for its employees. I think it's and getting that refreshed every several years definitely helps keep that knowledge in the forefront of your minds, knowing what to do, knowing how to move forward in these types of situations. So I appreciated that.
Evan and Anthony, this is Gary, and I'd like to thank you personally for what you've done, both as just humanitarians and also as the face and the name of Chelan PUD. But I'd also like to thank your parents, because they raised a couple of good guys that would go out of their way to help another human being in desperate need. So all around good guys. Appreciate what you did, both personally as a human, but also I appreciate what you did as a commissioner for representing this organization in the public eye. Thank you very much. Really need more people like you in the world.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. You know, it should be added too, we'll probably rise to the level of nominating this to for state awards too, but we'll see what happens there. But thanks again, Evan. Thanks again, Anthony. And thank you.
Steve, I noticed you brought your picture back up. Would you like to make some last comments?
I would like to just say one more thing. Obviously, we feel terrific about just being associated with people like Evan and Anthony. Evan mentioned the internal safety training that's provided. Dave Parkle has been doing that for a lot of years, and I wanted to commend him as well for the commitment that he's made to making sure that our employees have that training available to them that Evan was able to utilize. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Next, we'll move to reports. We've got the quarterly financial review and investment report, and Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics, and Dave Nelson, Manager of Strategic Financial Planning, will be making this presentation.
Great. Thank you, Sean. I appreciate that. As mentioned, Mark Mullins, Director of Enterprise Planning, Risk, and Analytics, and Dave Nelson and I will present this jointly quarterly financial review for quarter ended June 30th, 2021. So starting with the formalities, this presentation does support a number of resolutions that require quarterly reporting to the board on compliance with our long-range financial policies, business line financial policies, and also our investment policy, as well as our board's balanced scorecard objective of maintaining strong financial stewardship. So we'll go through the materials relatively quickly. I think you'll see the results are going well through Q2, and we'll jump right in. Next page. So we'll cover our financial highlights, look at our second quarter results, take a peek at our five-year forecast, a glance at our investment report, and leave you with some key messages. This is an update only, no action required. There is additional information in the appendix, but we won't be covering those today. So looking at our Q2 2021 key highlights, bottom line results through Q2 are $45 million, better than budget by $21 million. Lower operating costs and higher revenue from retained surplus proceeds are more than offsetting our lower local retail revenues through Q2. From a forecast perspective, expected to end the year at $70 million, better than budget by $19 million. The drivers there, we continue to see high prices in the wholesale market, so higher operating revenues are expected to continue for the year. We do have a number of significant projects well underway on the capital and O&M side. Those schedules will continue to be fine-tuned as we move throughout the year. But at this point in time, we are reflecting heavy spending forecasted for the remainder of 2021. Our financial metrics are being met for the five-year planning horizon with expected borrowing in 2023 to help fund a portion of our capital and spending program as we continue to invest in our assets. From a COVID-19 standpoint, our financial impacts are continuing to be manageable, although that is continuing to be a volatile area, certainly, but continues to be manageable for the district. So we're recommending at this point to stay the course with our 2020 through 2024 strategic goals. So looking at our income statement from a revenue perspective, service revenue is below budget by $1 million. A couple of moving parts, the red arrow would indicate below budget, the green arrow up indicates better than budget. The Diamond Foundry ramping plan continues to lag, so we're a little bit below budget from that perspective. Commercial sales are impacted by COVID-19, so their usage is at 91% for the year to date. Off-system end-use sales, while their usage is down, we're seeing significant market prices, or their market price rate component is pushing them above budget at this point in time, year to date. Net wholesale revenue is in line with budget. A few moving parts there as well. Lower energy production due to lower stream flow conditions. And that's offset by the lower retail use contributes to having more energy available to sell in the wholesale market to take advantage of those stronger market prices. Hydro contract revenue is $7 million above budget. Year to date, we have retained $9.6 million of retained surplus proceeds on our cost-based contract, and that's partially offset by our lower cost of production with lower spending at the hydros. Other operating revenues, $2 million above budget. This is primarily due to the variable portion of our real-time agreement. And total revenues forecasted to be $17 million above budget for the year. By comparison, in Q1, we are forecasting to be just under $4 million, so an improvement there. On the expense side, operating expenses are through Q2, $12 million below budget. As mentioned earlier, hydro O&M is lower versus budget at this point in the year, 82%, and distribution at 87%. But we are expected to catch up through the remainder of the year and be fairly close to budget. On the non-operating net expenses, better than budget by $2 million. We've had some customer line extension contributions that have been exceeding budget there, so contributing to that. So total net expenditures forecasted to be $2 million below budget for the year. Through Q1, that was forecasted to be $2.8 million below. So from a bottom line perspective, $45 million year to date through Q2, $21 million better than budget, with the primary drivers being lower expenses and higher contract revenue through those retained surplus proceeds. Bottom line forecast, $70 million or $19 million better than budget. This is from Q1 comparison, about $7 million at Q1. So definitely seeing an improvement there as well. Moving over to the balance sheet, looking at our capital spending through Q2, we spent $51 million, 68% of our budget or $24 million below budget year to date. Through the year, we're expected to spend $182 million, or about $8 million below budget, so slightly lower than our Q1 forecast, that was expected to be really close to budget. There are a number of moving parts, of course, with the capital forecast adjustments. We're seeing some money that was budgeted in 2020 that is now moving over into 2021, where you see those red arrows with the Rocky Reach central maintenance facilities and some bridge crane work, gantry crane work at Powerhouse 2 as one of the drivers. And then, of course, the green arrows where we're showing less spending for 2021. We have the operations and service center Powerhouse 1 modernization delays, as well as some substation schedule adjustments, are primary drivers there. From a cash perspective, ending Q2 with a balance of $625 million, a decrease from year-end of $46 million, as we continue to reduce debt and spend on our capital program, as we continue to invest in our assets and continue with our scheduled debt reductions. Year-end cash balance forecasted to be at $466 million, or $31 million better than budget. From a debt perspective, right in line with budget, our Q2 debt balance is $488 million. We do have $73 million of retirement scheduled for 2021. This is part of our 2020 debt refinance work that we were doing, along with some net scheduled payments as well. Forecasted to end the year at $396 million, down $110 million from where we're at 12/31, so right in line with budget with our expectations. Unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Dave Nelson.
Commissioners, any questions? I guess keep moving then, Dave.
Thank you, Commissioners. Thank you, Mark. This first slide here brings all that those results together in our bottom line forecast results for 2021. The variance that Mark discussed, resulting in a bottom line of $70 million compared to our budget of $51 million, $19 million better than budget is our projected result. The next slide, the summary of our bottom line, looking at it from a business line perspective. Just note a couple of things. The higher retail revenues combined with higher retained surplus revenues are what drives the integrated electric up, the variances Mark discussed. On the water side, revenues are forecast in line with budget, but expenses are forecast below budget. And then I would note on the interest system eliminations, those are related to the fiber distribution make-ready work and an increase due to planned acceleration of that work during the year.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah.
Before you move on, can I ask you just to maybe dive in just a little bit to the interest system eliminations? I'm not familiar with that. Can you explain how that works?
So this view is attempting to show by business line. And so in the case of the integrated electric, we have some costs associated with make-ready work that are that we want to break out separately and not include in the cost for integrated electric, and we're not showing them in the cost of fiber telecom either as their direct cost. So this is it would be showing a transfer in effect there to fiber and telecom in order to do that work, and that shows up as a revenue, and really, you know, we just want to show it as a transfer. So we want to break that out to show the results more on an operational basis up above, and then the inter system eliminations are reflecting that transfer.
Got it. Okay, thank you. I transferred, when you said the word transfer, that helped click for me. Thank you.
Okay. And on the next slide, we've got capital expenditures by system. The first three columns are representing year-to-date results, and I would just note that they're primarily, as Mark discussed, lagging the budget due to delays to the Rock Island modernization projects and internal services, operations, and service center spending. And then the last three columns on a full-year basis, and there we have electric distribution forecasting spending 79% of their budget due to the revised schedules for substation work, reducing that forecast. Most of the remaining systems are forecasting being close to budget by the end of the year. Fiber and telecom forecasting 159% of budget due to both to 2020 budget carry forwards and allocation of PPV capital to accelerated distribution tower scheduled for 2023 was brought forward to 2021. And you would be expecting to see a budget revision request for the capital system for fiber and telecom at some point here coming up. Okay, The next slide is an overview of the 2021 cash flow year to date. $45 million bottom line results so far, adding back depreciation, $23 million gives us $68 million for funds earned from operations. We had the capital project expenditures so far for the year of $51 million. The net debt expense, activity, primarily the payment, the principal payment of $23 million impacting that. Other miscellaneous impacts, mostly pay downs of year-end balances of accounts payable, $45 million, resulting in an overall estimated use of funds of $114 million. Netting that with the funds earned from operations gives us a $46 million use of funds for the first half of the year. Started with $671 million, less the $46 gets us to the $625 balance. $1 million balance we have at the end of the second quarter. The next slide. The breakdown of where that cash is on our balance sheet. We have, of course, the $50 million in board designated funds for the service center. We're anticipating that those would be used in 2022 after the use of the bond proceeds. You can see the impact of the $90 million internal loan made in March on the restricted cash for the hydros, with the balance increasing to $112 million net of project expenditures. And I would just note that there is a decrease of only $13 million in cash, the total liquidity figures that we used compared to our policy minimum of $175 million. And that's because much of our secondary liquidity restricted balances have actually declined as debt has been paid down and construction funds used, being in those first two items. Overall, cash going from 671 at the end of the year to 625 at 630. Next slide. Okay, this is our quarterly financial policies metrics. I would note that the recent 5- and 10-year slices are now reflected in the future years above. The district continues to meet its financial policy metrics over the 5-year planning horizon. However, we do fully utilize our excess cash reserves above policy requirements to execute our capital plans. Note that the yellow indicates that we're within 10% of those metrics. And also note the combined debt cover ratio in 2022 is actually at though it's still yellow, it's actually slightly better than the first quarter, and that one is driven in large part by the Rocky Beach large unit repairs and the timing of those. And then as those are completed, the ratio jumps back up and improves in future years. Next page. This is the individual business line financial policies and the forecast for 2024 for water, wastewater, and fiber. And as you can see, the results are mixed, and we're still working on improving, becoming more self-sustaining over the long term in these systems. Next page. The summary of the quarterly investment report prepared by our Treasury Department. And I just note a couple things. The district yield decreased to 1.8% for the quarter, but that still compares favorably to the benchmarks, so either the 3-month T-bill or the S&P U.S. Treasury 1-to-3-year index. And we are meeting all of our policy objectives and our compliance requirements. To the next page. So our key messages for Q2, the forecasts are better than budget. District's capital plans are significant and expected to fully utilize our excess cash reserves to fund the 5-year plan. We are very financially healthy and on track with our financial metrics. However, the district is forecasting new debt issuance in 2023, despite the proposed rate increase plans considered in the forecast. And staff recommends staying the course and executing on the 2020 to 2024 strategic plan goals. That's the presentation for today. Any questions?
Thank you, Mark and Dave. Questions from commissioners? those, actually, there's some pretty amazing numbers in there. That's all I can say. And I'm sure we'll get into the conversation with our next presenter, but I'd like to congratulate staff on keeping on top of all the moving parts. There's a lot of moving parts, and we appreciate what you're doing. Any other comments,
happy
questions?
Happy to be where we are. Yeah. Happy to be where we are. Yeah.
And Mark and Dave, a message that you could take back to your fellow folks in the finance department, and that is congratulations on presenting a really great financial outlook. You know, there it would be hard pressed for any other utility anywhere in the United States to throw up the kind of numbers that you guys are throwing up. They look great. I hope our ratepayers fully grasp and understand the significance of the surpluses that you're reporting on and the great financial health that we have as an organization. Certainly the community should be proud of everyone at the district as they work hard to exceed expectations. And on a routine basis, you guys have continued to exceed expectations. So thank you very much. Make sure you please take that message back. Great job.
Thank you, commissioners, and we will take that feedback back to staff. I know there's a lot of hard work that goes on behind these numbers, and really proud to be able to present those financial results. So thank you very much for that.
Okay.
Okay, Sean?
Yes, thank you. Next up is the quarterly energy resources update for Q2 2021. Myself, Managing Director of Energy Resources, and Janet Jaspers, Director of Energy Operations Planning and Trading, will be making this presentation. If we go to the next page there, why we're here, basically, portfolio overview, pricing update, and then net wholesale revenue forecast update, and also a market update. As you've heard before, the resolution requires us to come quarterly to report to the board. So we also will have additional detailed information not covered here is in the appendix. If you go to the third slide there, the district revenue net wholesale is up, is actually slightly below target, but still in line with revenue projections. So we're still at 96%. It's $2.9 million from budget. So we call that in line with budget. Other related revenue are forecast to be $21 million, which is $11 million more. So when you combine those, we get $8.5 million roughly above budget for 2021. If I go to the next page, we'll be talking in more detail about resource adequacy in Rob Davis's presentation, but the design phase is out now, and so we will go into detail there. And we are actually in the summer 2021. We're doing showings here as a test run, basically. And it has actually been used in late June and early July, or in late July, I should say, with this extreme heat going on. In the short-term markets, the CAISO wheel-through filing passed at FERC. However, that did not go over well with a lot of entities in the Southwest. We had just about every utility in Arizona, along with the Arizona Corporation Commission and NV Energy in Nevada, filed protests on that ruling. They rely on California to wheel through energy from the Northwest hydropower. So that's something to keep an eye. We're keeping a close eye on, but Arizona and Nevada and a lot of the desert Southwest is very upset right now with the ISO. The president and CEO, Elliot Mainzer, does understand the issues with that, and he, he is saying that he will try to come up with a long-term solution for the wheel-through issue. However, it should be noted that is tough in their governance structure. They have a lot of issues with their California-centric governance structure. Sorry about that. Next. So CETA has been, we actually had presentations last week to the Department of Commerce where utilities and environmental groups proposed rulemaking for that. So you'll see this calendar, and we'll be very busy trying to wrap this up so it can start at January of 2022. More on the regional focus, the Southwest Power Pool, which we sometimes call SPP, has just passed, and they're expanding their footprint for RTO, and they also are opening up the Western Energy Imbalance Service. So you're going to see right there, there's probably going to be a little battle going on between the ISO and Southwest Power Pool for the states kind of in between both the Southwest Power Pool and the ISO going forward in the next coming years. If I go to the next page, you'll see sales and commitments within hedging limits, so which are shown on the red line. So nothing much has changed here. We're all looking good. And if I go to the next page, no updates since the last presentation. We are busy speaking with entities, but no actual updates to put on this chart yet. This next slide I will turn over to Janet.
Good morning, commissioners. This is Janet Jaspers, Director of Energy Planning and Trading. Thank you, Sean. Sean said we're going to start right off with kind of an update for prices for you. This chart is something new that we haven't brought before the board before today, but we thought it was pretty interesting. So all of these are daily prices of natural gas at different points across the West. And I think probably what's most interesting is to take a look at Malin, which is the most orange color to me, and then also Citygate, which is kind of looks like school bus yellow to me, so the orange versus the yellow. So Malin, which is the orange, is kind of on the California-Oregon border, so Northern California. And then that school bus yellow color one is in Southern California. So you can just see that usually those two kind of starting off in May on the left-hand side of the chart here, those two were pretty close and kind of went up and down together. But then kind of mid-June, around June 15th or so, you can see the school bus yellow one, which is SoCal City Gate, really spike up and really departure from the Malin. So kind of in California, you see these various spreads, which means congestion and different things happening. So pretty diverse pricing, just even of natural gas, which means diverse pricing of electricity. So I thought that was something kind of interesting. there is a natural gas hub called Sumas that is closer to Mid-Sea, what we call Mid-Sea right here. And it's kind of just north of us on the Canadian border. And that's really not available. We're trying to get what is available, but we might have to purchase that data point. And so we're going to work on getting that soonest point added to this chart. Next slide, please, slide 9. So we're taking a look at the September 2021 Henry Hub natural gas prices. So you can see last time we came to the board, it was $2.96. now we're at $4.16. Just the increase in demand with the real hot temperatures has caused us also kind of lower inventory heading into the fall. We haven't really seen some of the producer responding to this $4 price signal. What they're doing is kind of looking out at kind of sustained higher prices for the next 2 or 3 years. And they want that to be above a $3 handle before they start adding production. And so, given the state we're in, these prices really could stay throughout the fall and early winter. Slide 10. So if we kind of zoom out from the left and just kind of take a look at from like 2002 to 2021, I mean, you see all those high prices in 2005, 2008. So we're still really in a pretty relatively low natural gas price market. Next, on slide 11, we'll kind of switch from kind of how that natural gas does affect the electricity prices. Taking a look at the mid-season forward price curve, we have the black line, which is current, and the dashed gray line, which was at budget November 3rd, 2020. And so at budget, kind of a flat 2021 price was $31 per megawatt hour. And now, kind of for a flat for 2021, we're seeing probably around $55, which is an increase of $24 per megawatt hour. So a pretty steep increase. Out in the future years, 22 through 26, we're seeing kind of a price increase of probably $10 to $11 for flat electricity prices for that portion of the price curve. Slide 12. Also, this slide is a little bit different than what we typically bring, and it's just really included to show how volatile daily prices are, and daily prices are kind of just that next day trading. And we're seeing higher and higher volatility in those daily prices. And you can see kind of on the left-hand side of the graph, kind of through May, pretty low, always less than $50. Sometimes on weekends, you might see it drop close to zero, pretty high flows at that point also. Then you see some price spikes, usually during some hot temperatures. And you can see kind of out there at the end of July, I think it was July 28th or so, we actually saw pricing above $550 per megawatt hour. So pretty high volatility compared to the last couple of years. Slide 13, please. So, kind of in conjunction with the financial slides, I think Mark had reported on this top section of this slide, the net wholesale revenue subtotal in the top section. At budget time, $67.3 million. Our forecast right now, $64.4 million. So, $2.9 million lower. And that's mainly due to lower water in the Columbia Basin. The Grand Coulee January through July runoff was 89% of normal, so you really have only 89% of the inflow and probably close to that percent on your actual generation too. If we take a look at the lower section of the graph, at budget time, net wholesale revenue and energy and other energy-related revenue, $77.5 million. Now the forecast is $85.9 million. So together, $8.4 million above budget. And a large portion of really is the long-term power contract retained surplus proceeds, which was $9.6 million, adding to that result. Next slide, slide 14. So last quarter when we came to you, this on my screen, it looks like kind of lime green. what is the line? Currently, the solid black is our forecast for net wholesale revenue plus off-system and new sales. And you can see it's jumped up. I had described the electricity prices for this year probably were $24 per megawatt hour higher than at budget time. A lot of our surplus this year, well, we actually had low waters, and a lot of the surplus had already been hedged forward. But you can see kind of out in years 2023 through 2027, where we have quite a bit of unhedged energy still. We saw a significant increase in our wholesale revenue expectations. And then slide 15, please. So some other market information. Kind of some of those real volatile daily price spikes are really due to a lack of capacity across the West, and especially when we get real high temps or maybe low water, some other stresses on the system, we see those price spikes. So the Cal ISO was actually short on capacity. They put out seeking bids or seeking some offers from all of the utilities in the West, and they did that July 7th. And they were wanting capacity from 4 p.m. to 9 p.m., kind of when that solar drops off, pretty big ramp rate for them during that time. They were looking for to deliver at the intertime from transmission, and they put a cap on the pricing that they were willing to offer, which is $6.31 per kilowatt month, which is a pretty low price for this capacity-tight market right now. They haven't really published what they have taken for offers, but we've heard a lot of rumors that there were hardly any offers to the Cal ISO at that price. And then we did hear rumors of some transactions being done outside the solicitation, kind of some bilaterals that were much, much higher price than that price cap that they did put in place. So slide 16, please. So kind of in summary again, don't want to repeat everything, but kind of bottom line, 8.4 million above budget for 2021. And this concludes the presentation from Energy Resources, and we'd be happy to entertain questions at this time.
Thank you. Commissioners, any questions? It certainly appears we've entered a new era, energy market, and volatility is probably going to be with us for some time. So we appreciate what you're bringing to the table. We appreciate the work you're having to do.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Smith.
May I say something?
You bet.
Thank you. So, Janet, I'm trying to chew this up in my head here, and so please forgive me if I'm maybe a little naive on my question, but if I'm reading this correctly in your chart of forward wholesale pricing, it would indicate that we're in a projected increase in wholesale pricing going forward, and only limited by the amount of water coming down the river. Would that be an accurate assumption?
Those are the current projections that, you know, that's what the market is telling us. Will that come to fruition is the big question mark here.
Right. That's the crystal ball projection.
Yes.
So it would indicate that the volatility sometimes can be your friend. Other times it can take you to the cleaner. So you got to be really careful with it. It sounds like we've got the right crew on hand to really maximize the benefit of the wholesale power. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. Janet, I don't know if you had anything to add to that.
Yeah, so I think on slide 11, if we could just show slide 11, pricing is pretty high this year. So kind of what it's going to do kind of in 22, 23, I think there's still going to be some capacity shortages in 22 and 23. People are trying to build out capacity. We have resource adequacy program going into play, so people are putting out RFPs trying to get some capacity purchased in there. So I think, yeah, kind of overall, it looks pretty, kind of the pricing looks pretty flat out into the future. And so this is just the energy pricing. There's two other components to our hydro. The second component is really the clean aspect or the carbon-free component. And if you were to graph that, we don't have a graph of that here, but that's really going up, especially with the Clean Energy Transformation Act in the future. And a lot of the other state legislation. And so the third piece, besides the energy and the carbon-free attribute, is really kind of that flexible capacity component, which our hydro has too, or resource adequacy value. You might call it resource adequacy value or capacity value. And that kind of is an additional value to our hydro product that we can capture additional value in the marketplace for that.
And then the final thing I think there to add is on cap and invest, when that comes into play, when natural gas resources are in the market and in the money, they'll have to basically add that adder, which will increase the whole market revenue there, because that price then kicks up and we don't have to add that adder as a carbon-free resource.
Thank you. Yeah, I appreciate that definition, and Janet, good explanation. And of course, the market always responds to higher prices by building additional capacity to take advantage of those higher prices. So you're absolutely on target. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions from commissioners? Hearing none, thanks again. We're in a new world. That's all I can say. item six, Sean, do you want
yes.
to...
I'll introduce Rob Davis, who is our staff attorney here, who's been following the Northwest Power Pool release of the Resource Adequacy Program. There was a symposium last week, and we're really starting to move forward, and Rob's been with it kind of every step of the way, and so it was an appropriate time to give the board an update.
Morning, Commissioners. Rob Davis, staff attorney with the district. Thanks for that introduction, Sean, and I couldn't have had a better lead-in than that last presentation for what we're going to talk about on resource adequacy today. We came to you last spring with some information on the program itself and then another presentation on governance, and we're going to talk about both of those things, the technical side and the governance piece today. As Sean mentioned, there was a symposium, and it was timed out to coincide with a big milestone in the program. So a lot of new stuff to talk with you about. And, if you have any questions along the way, please let us know. Next slide, please. It's a little more detail on what we're going to talk about. We're going to start off going over why it's important. We've touched on all of these things, but we really want to highlight the importance of the program again before we get into the details. We'll cover the program elements themselves, tell you what's new since the last time we had a discussion with you. We'll go over the timeline for things we've done and what's remaining, and then we'll get into some details about this next phase that we're starting now, and close out with what our next steps will be in the program. Next slide. So why is the region doing resource adequacy? So this is a pretty large focus. We've been spending a lot of time on it, both in the region and at the district, and it is, want to highlight for you, what makes it important. So throughout the West, we're seeing a lot of ongoing resource retirements. Coal gets a lot of the attention, but we're seeing other retirements as well. The Diablo Canyon down in California will be going offline soon. A lot of the ones through cooling plants in California, the gas plants have gone offline. There's a lot of baseload resources that are being replaced with wind and solar, which is leading to more volatility in production, less predictability. And so this is, you know, it's not just happening in one spot, it's happening across the West. And so as a region, we have to respond to retirements in our own region, but we're also less dependent on imports, or less able to be dependent on imports from other regions. We're all facing the same sort of stress in that regard. Similarly, we're seeing shifting weather patterns across the West. Things like the intertie were designed decades ago to take advantage of regional diversity between winter and summer peaks, you know, different water years between regions. But in the past few years, we've seen weather events that have been west-wide. This summer in particular, our heat excursions that didn't just cover one region but covered the entire West, stressing everyone at the same time. We're seeing a low water up here, water year up here. We're also seeing extreme drought in California. Again, stress across the West. Along with these shifting weather patterns, we're seeing increased wildfire risk. So this is something that you've been keeping track of course, and is in the news, and we're seeing wildfires across the West. And an effect of that on the energy delivery is that it's causing people to limit transmission capability between regions. Just this summer, we had the interties down for a few days because of a fire down in southern Oregon, which severely limited the ability of power to flow into California. Along with this, we've seen multiple studies that have told us that we have a resource adequacy problem coming. These have been done by utilities, utility trade groups, I think even some regulators. It's been pretty consistent pointing out that we have a resource adequacy problem in the Northwest and in the greater West. The Power Council has put out a recent report. They're finalizing their latest plan. Prevents a more optimistic outlook, but that's gotten some pushback from folks in the West who have asked whether all the assumptions and all the modeling are accurate. It takes a what was a pretty dire prediction and makes it look almost rosy. So we're staying in communication with the council to make sure that we get some accurate reporting out there. But thankfully, the utilities in the region are still pressing forward with this program because of all the other elements. We see it as continuing to be necessary for continued reliable service. Next slide. So more specifically, why are we as a utility participating in resource adequacy? And we've mentioned before, we're a long utility, we are a leading utility in regional initiatives, and we are a good neighbor. But more specifically, we prefer stable and less volatile markets, and resource adequacy helps. If we have more assured supply, more certainty about that supply, particularly when the grid is stressed and supply gets tight, then that helps stabilize the markets. To get there, we're going to need mandatory requirements. So we're setting up a voluntary program. We're encouraging utilities to apply. But once you're in, there's a commitment amongst everybody to other program participants that we will all meet our own needs, including a sufficient margin for uncertainty, and that with that assuredness to each other that we can provide for reliability across the footprint. There are policy reasons for this as well. There have been repeated calls both at the regional level and at the national level to start investigating a West-wide RTO. And we have investigated that many times. It's a difficult thing for a number of reasons to advance in the Northwest. But this resource adequacy program, conversely, has advanced very well for regional initiative. There's been a singular focus on solving a very specific problem, and that has allowed utilities to reach consensus on things that are not ideal for everyone. I don't think anybody in this program is going to look at it and say, this is exactly how I would have designed it. But because it is focused on one problem and making sure that we solve it correctly, we're able to make good strides, and I think that will set us up, if there's going to be an RTO in the future, that we'll have a good foundation for that. Excuse me. Next slide. So these are things that we have talked about before. I'll give you a little refresher and then touch on some of the things that are new. So the forward showing program is the part of the program where 7 months in advance, all the utilities come together. They're assigned a share of the regional resource requirement, and each utility demonstrates how they're going to meet that with either resources or contracts, so that when we get into the operational time frame, everyone has adequate resources to meet their forecasted peaks. New since our last time talking with you is that we've addressed the problem of making sure that those resources can actually get to load. So it's not enough to just say that I've got resources built and resources on contract. If I can't get them to where the energy needs to go for load service, then it's not worth anything. So we have added transmission and deliverability requirements to the program to make sure that the resources that we're pointing to can actually serve the load that we're planning for. In the operational program, this is once we get into the actual peak periods, making sure that when the forecasts become more granular, when we get into the actual production days, that you know those resources that folks are holding and that reserve margin that we plan for can be used to meet load if somebody is exceeding where they thought they would be. So since our last update, we've added a process to work through how that is actually provided to participants. So the idea that if you have surplus, that there's a mechanism now for how you hold back that capacity going into the operational time frame, and how that would be deployed if somebody had met their forward showing requirements but then came up short because of load over forecast or wind and solar under forecast or perhaps other unplanned outages that would necessitate that they come to the pool for assistance. Finally, on governance, we've had an entire presentation on that, talking through some of the necessary elements. We have begun refining those elements. The last time we spoke with you, there was uncertainty about where the program would be housed and what role the power pool would have. We've now identified a role for the power pool. We've also identified more discrete roles for stakeholders. Collaboration is really ingrained in this region, and so we've had a lot of communication with stakeholders along the way about how they can be involved in the program, and we've fleshed that out for the latest proposal. Next slide. So this is the timeline you're familiar with. We've flashed it to you a couple times. The thing that I really want to point out is that the red arrow has now moved over Chevron. So we have gone from the phase two. We finished up all the detailed design work on the program itself. We used to call it a final design, but realized that it's never truly final. We still have a lot of things that we need to test and revise, but the framework is there. Most of the details are there. And we're going into now phase 3A to start the non-binding program itself. So this will be when people sign up, follow the rules, start working through all the processes. It's called non-binding because there won't be penalties in this phase. But it's kind of like a beta test for the program to make sure it works before we get into part of the program where we do have penalties. Next slide.
Did you say how long that testing time will last? I missed that if you did.
I did not. So this is going to go through the end of 2022, roughly. So folks have a sign-up window from, I think, now until the end of September to sign up for the program. During design, it has been mainly power pool members, the balancing authorities, a few of the larger load-serving entities like Snohomish and Eugene, EWEB. But we're opening it up now to any load-serving entity. And so that window opens up for people to sign up to be part of the program. And we'll do a couple seasons. And then December 2022, we're going to have an opportunity for people to sign up again. So signing up for the non-binding program doesn't put you in through the end of time into the resource adequacy program. Folks have an opportunity to make sure it works for them. But then we will have a sign-up window in December of 2022 for the binding program. We expect that, I think, in March of 2023 is when we're looking to have the first first forward showing made. That's when we anticipate having to have all our FERC approvals, have the new governance program in place. So that's kind of the timeline for the next phase.
Thank you.
Certainly. So as I mentioned, we're opening up the program now to all load responsible entities. We've gotten some response from folks that they are interested. For example, some of BPA's slice customers who are not balancing authorities are asking about the program and what it would take. We're reaching out to some of the direct access utilities and service territories in Oregon and Montana and Nevada and really starting to make a push because, again, the more participation we get, the better program we have and the more diversity we can share. Moving forward, participation when folks decide that they want to join will be done through a participation agreement with the power pool. We are going to set out all the various things, voting rights on committees, funding obligations, data sharing obligations. We have been moving under kind of a consensus format, so now this will be formal contractual obligations to one another in the program. And participation will be set up both for voting and for cost allocation using a House and Senate approach. And so we're all familiar with kind of the bicameral approach so that the larger utilities are paying their share, but at the same time, they don't have the ability to run roughshod over the smaller utilities. So for voting purposes, there will be two thresholds that have to be passed. In the Senate style, each utility gets one vote, and you have to pass the required percentage. And on the House side, it will be load-weighted based on our P50 forecasts that are used to determine our resource adequacy requirements. Similarly, for funding, half of the total funding for the non-binding program will be allocated pro rata to each utility that signs up, and the other half will be allocated on a load-weighted basis, again, using the P50. On the governance side, we're going to move to a more formal process as well. So it had been generally consensus at the steering committee level, and then we would take that to the executive committee for ratification, feedback, change in direction if necessary. So now we're going to go with the committee structures that we've been setting up, put those in place, and use those for making the large decisions. Still working through some of those details, but we are going to stand up the participants committee. So this is the resource adequacy participants committee that for the non-binding phase, since we won't have an independent board in place, will be the decision-making body. And then once we have the independent board in place, which will have the ultimate authority over the program, the plan is that the RAPC would still have its delegated authority that then the board has oversight over. On to the next slide, we see a graphical representation of what the governance is going to look like in the non-binding phase. Next few slides, we're going to talk about governance because it is still moving, but a big focus for us. So as I mentioned up at the top here, you have the participants committee. So this will be any load responsible entity that decides to join the program. So that could be a load service utility, or it could be somebody that's taken on load service responsibilities and is an agent for various utilities. We will be keeping the power pool in its current form for this and using service agreements to access staff, access facilities, and for them to contract out to any necessary contractors. Off to the left there, we have a couple other committees. We have a nominating committee and the Committee of States, and both of these will be under formation during the non-binding phase so that we can get them in place when we get to the full program. So the nominating committee will be sector-based. That is, there'll be investor-owned representative, consumer-owned representatives, representatives for BPA, various public interest organizations will pick their representative, and so on down the line, that will be responsible for nominating the independent directors that would sit on the board of the reformed power pool. There will be protections in there, for example, a seat for any utility that's a power pool member but not participating in RA, We'll have someone from the Committee of States so that the state energy offices and regulators will have some input as well. And so that committee will be standing up, setting its own rules. We're finalizing the process to find out, finalizing the details around the committee before we finish Phase 3A. The Committee of States, as I mentioned, is the regulators or state energy officials. And so this will be an opportunity for those folks to provide input to the program since they still have resource authority over the investor-owned utilities that are participating. There's a separate process outside of the power pools process, working with them to really define the role, and that's going to be finalized in this phase as well. We certainly acknowledge that there's a tension between too much authority for that committee, given the large number of public power utilities that are participating, but also not giving them sufficient voice in the program such that they would make it difficult or impossible for the investor owns to join. So we're trying to work through that process in a very methodical way to make sure we get the right balance there. We've also proposed a program review committee. So this is down there, that lower level. The idea of the program review committee is to have a targeted stakeholder forum. So rather than just asking, for example, consumer protection agencies or environmental interest groups or energy trade organizations to sit in the public meetings and provide input that may be dampened out, even though they have specific insight into possible improvements, we've set up a committee that will be kind of a clearinghouse for program design changes that will have both participant and stakeholder input and feedback before things get to the participants committee for final decision. And then the last thing I'd note there, the little green box, is the program operator. So the power pool will be contracting out for the services to actually do the technical operation of the program. And so that is not part of the actual governance itself, but we'll have feedback both to participants, to stakeholders, to the power pool itself through their contractual arrangement. And at the symposium, we announced that we will be going forward with the Southwest Power Pool to provide these services. So they were involved with the design process, some very good inputs, real good help along the way. We did not just adopt the Southwest Power Pool's own resource adequacy program, but we did take a lot of insight from them as we put this together, and we're bringing them on to run the program for us. Next slide, please. So as we move into the 3B, the binding program, the big change I'd like to highlight for you here is that blue dashed box around all the little blue rectangles. So we are reforming the power pool. This is where we institute the independent board of directors, a change from currently with the semi-independent but self-perpetuating board. And so the new power pool, in addition to having those independent directors, will incorporate the governance elements of the RA program into its governance framework, so that this is going to become a little more permanent, that we'll have these formal RA governance rules in place. You see there we have a lot of the same elements, though. We still have our nominating committee, our participants committee, our program review committee, and our committee of states all within that framework. I'd also like to note for you that as we've mentioned, we have a lot of value in the other programs that the power pool runs, the reserve sharing, the frequency response program, their support services to Northern Grid, for example, and those will continue. Those are all the colored boxes off to the right. The power pool will continue to provide those services, just not within the, not collapsed into the framework of resource adequacy. The other addition here, when we get to the binding phase, you see we still have the contracted for program operator down there at the bottom. We will also be contracting with an independent program evaluator. This is not a market monitor because we're not standing up a market. We're not asking somebody to come in and monitor each utility that's participating. This is really a chance for an independent review. Is the program providing the service that we wanted it to? Is it running the way that we designed it to provide feedback to participants and the board about whether we've accomplished the things we set out to accomplish? So really more of an audit type function, but it's important to have it independent so that we know we're getting good answers and can use that to make good changes going forward. So our next steps, said several times, and it's a lot of work left for us, but the governance details and all the paper that goes along with that. So a lot of contracts to be drafted, a lot of policies and committee charters, things like that. Some of the details that we have to work through still are committee process, dispute resolution, exit provisions in case things are not going well, making sure that one party departing doesn't improperly affect the remaining parties. So all this will be finalized in the coming year so that we can present a package to FERC for their approval, make sure we're ready to go for the binding phase when it starts up in 2023. We have to actually hire the market operator, although we've acknowledged it's going to be Southwest Power Pool. We are currently drafting the agreement to make sure that we can get all on the same page and start the technical setup for the program. And then, as I mentioned, we're going to file with FERC. Target is for March of 2022 to give ourselves enough time for FERC to review, possibly send back any questions or revisions, and then address those and get a final order. Give ourselves a year to have everything ready so that we can get the program up and running. And there will be other steps along the way for the power pool, the Northwest Power Pool, as it transitions to being a public utility under the Federal Power Act. So a lot of work left in the upcoming year, but the good news is we've got a lot of consensus on the really important pieces, and now we're getting down to details and finer points.
Wow. Thank you. Commissioners, questions or comments, commissioners?
Randy, I couldn't have said it better myself. Wow.
And I'd like to add, you know, we'd really like to thank Rob and everybody in Energy Resources and throughout the district that's working on this. This is a big, heavy lift, but very important. With capacity, it could add a lot of value to our product, especially when you compare it to other carbon-free resources that only produce, for instance, when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and we fill in a lot of those gaps, and capacity defined correctly could add a lot of value to us. So thank you.
Hey, this is Ann. Rob and everybody, thank you very much. Wow, that was a great report. That's going to take some time for me to absorb it all. I'll have to reread it at least once, but it sounds terrific. I'm glad we're so far down the road on this. Thanks again.
Certainly.
Well, we look forward to hearing more. We really do. Yeah.
So next up on the...
We'll certainly be back with more.
And slightly related to that, Rob's also going to talk about our progress on our interconnection agreement template update. So if you look at, you know, out into the market, into the future, not market per se, resource adequacy, you know, you'll see they will have to build resources down the road. And so they'll look for... and many different balancing authorities to interconnect. And so it's very important that we keep progressing on this. And so Rob's going to go through where we are currently on that.
Thanks. So again, Rob Davis, staff attorney. Switching gears to transmission. This is another one where we've spoken with you about the work we're doing, and this is a finer detail update. No action required today, but just to give you a heads up, we are trying to finalize this so we can come back to you next month for final approval of our template. Next slide. I'm going to go over the background again, some of the history of the, I guess, motivating forces or governing forces on interconnection and transmission. We'll talk about our total package of transmission initiatives so you can see where this fits in. Little description of the interconnection process, again, so you can see where the interconnection agreement fits into that, and highlight some more agreement details. And then cap off with what we're going to do next. So our background again, we're taking on this project to better align ourselves with the industry standard around transmission and interconnection. It's the industry standard because it's been in place for a long time, and along the way, FERC has gotten additional authority to move us in that direction if we were doing something that they found less than ideal. Well, maybe not less than ideal, but more specifically discriminatory. So again, in the Energy Policy Act of 92, FERC got the authority to require utilities to take action related to transmission and interconnection, including non-jurisdictionals like ourselves. A few years later, they adopted their pro forma tariff. It was voluntarily adopted by several LPPC members. We were not one of those, but we have been investigating it for some time now. The interconnection piece was added by FERC in Order 2003, so that is now part of the OAT, both the process and the form agreement itself. And then in the Energy Policy Act of 2005, FERC got additional and broader authority to remedy discrimination by utilities, including non-jurisdictionals like ourselves. So against that backdrop, and based on some decisions made a few years ago here at the district, we've been working on a number of transmission initiatives. Bringing to you a little graphical layout this time so you can kind of see some of the interrelationships. So we have our transmission rates, which the board approved last summer. Those are in place and being used. We have there at the same level just the broad overlay of transmission policies and procedures. So this is, generally speaking, the tariff and our related business practices. That would include our standard of conduct policy, any of the enabling practices over in the transmission group. Within that set of transmission policies and procedures, we have the transmission agreement itself. So if an entity came to the district and wanted to take transmission service, they would sign an agreement. It would be governed by those policies, and the transmission rates that have been applied or have been approved would apply to that contract. So the policies and transmission service agreement are still in process. After we finish up the interconnection stuff, we're going to bring those back to the board with updates and eventually a request for approval towards the end of the year. They are pretty near final, but not final enough to bring them at this time. So we will be coming back with those, though. Also under the broader umbrella of transmission policies and procedures is the interconnection process. And within that is the template agreement, which we are going to, we have listed there in green as under review. So we are giving you this last update before we bring to you the final agreement itself and resolution requesting approval. And looking at this, it would make sense to maybe start finalizing the policies and procedures first, and then as part of that, all of these other things would be in place. And the reason we're coming out of order is because we've actually had requests that may need an interconnection agreement in place, and we didn't want to hold that up any more than we had to if we could get the contract approved. So many, many years with no requests from anybody, but in last couple of years, we've had a couple formal requests and several inquiries that have been almost serious. So wanted to get this wrapped up, and then we'll get the rest wrapped up and have everything in place going forward. Next slide, please. Just a little more detail on how we're coming to you. Again, get approval of this interconnection agreement by the end of Q3. I think previously we said Q2, but some other things caused it to push out, resource adequacy being one of them. Come to you by the end of the year for review and approval of the policies and procedures. And then, again, just a note there at the end that we have, within that interconnection process, a large load process that was developed during the first crypto boom and that follows the same process as the the generators and the tariff policy, but has additional steps to make sure that we're including the distribution group, the customer utilities folks, to get the complete picture on what needs to happen. Next slide, please. So just an overview of the interconnection process. That it starts with an application. This is the formal request in writing that kicks off all the work on our side and reserves a place as it's first come, first serve in most cases, reserves the place for the customer that's looking to hook up. Once they've given us their application, we run through a series of studies, make sure that their request is feasible and makes sense. If it does, we move on to make sure or to examine what the impacts are to our system, and then finally to study what specific facilities they would have to build. There are a number of related studies for our neighboring systems. There might be environmental or natural resources studies that the customer would have to do. Throughout this whole process, the interconnection customer is responsible for all their own study costs. They post deposits to cover those costs, and then we true up at the end of the studies. Following all that, if the customer wants to move forward with interconnection, we have an interconnection agreement that sets out all the terms and conditions. This applies to large loads that are over 5 megawatts that affect our transmission system. We've had one request, and we've had several inquiries. It also applies to large generators. These are generators over 20 megawatts, and there we've had one formal request and several inquiries. So a lot of attention to the district's transmission system and people looking to locate things here in the county, so we want to make sure we're prepared when they come knocking. Finally, just to note that this process only covers interconnection, and if the customer wants transmission service, which logically they would, but they have to request it separately. It is studied separately, and then there's the standalone transmission service agreement. So it is a separate process, and we run through both of them in all cases. Next slide. So here's some of the highlights for you. Probably a little more detail than when we came to you the last time. Start by noting that this is a template agreement that we're going to be bringing to you. Based on FERC's template, we have within there some customer-specific elements. Even though it is a template, each interconnection is going to have its own differences, its own specifics that it needs for interconnection. Those will be based on the design of the facility, different study results, which could be influenced by location or expected use, and even the interconnection customer's schedule. So all of those things will be memorialized in appendices. The template has the appendices, and we fill them in based on the customer. The rest of the agreement is largely unchanged from customer to customer. The agreement, important for protecting our own customer owners, is that it assigns the cost responsibility for the interconnection to the interconnection customer. So the interconnection customer is responsible for designing and procuring equipment and constructing the interconnection facilities on both its side and the district side. The district will handle the design and construction. The district handles design and procurement and construction on our side, but the customer is responsible for all of those costs. So the cost is entirely on the interconnection customer for all those facilities. To the extent an interconnection requires upgrades to our transmission system or distribution system, the customer is also responsible for those costs. The only exception there is that if it is upgrades to the transmission system, then the customer gets a credit for those against their transmission bill as they take transmission service. So they fund the upfront capital costs on the transmission upgrades and get a credit for those. But that's really the only exception to the total cost responsibility for the interconnection. And then going forward, the interconnection customer is responsible for O&M costs, both facilities they own and the facilities that we own. The agreement assigns some operational responsibilities to the customer, so they are required to give us all the data we need to successfully operate the system. They're required for putting in place system protection, equipment, and procedures. We coordinate on outages both on our side and their side, to make sure that we can operate reliably. We coordinate on maintenance and also emergencies. So the customer takes on obligations for all these things to make sure that their interconnection doesn't adversely affect our system. And then finally, for large loads, I think we mentioned this at the last update, but we now have language in place. The large loads are required to take on responsibility for meeting resource quality requirements. So this means any regulatory style requirement, whether it's the Clean Energy Transformation Act, the Energy Independence Act, the Resource Adequacy Program, the large load takes on that responsibility instead of pushing it onto the district to be met by our existing customer owners. So, for example, a large load comes to the county and wants to hook up a 100-megawatt server farm, and that would ordinarily add to our RPS and conservation requirements, we would require through the interconnection agreement that large load take on that responsibility. And we have a provision in there that they're going to protect us from any compliance costs or penalties related to that if they don't meet that requirement. So that is kind of the high points. I'm happy to answer any other questions about the interconnection agreement itself. It is a very dense document, which you will see when we get it circulated to you, but wanted to make sure we hit some of these high points about how the agreement protects the district and keeps our customer owners whole. Then on the next slide, just to reiterate our steps, we're going to come back to you very soon with the finalized template agreement to get your approval to use it going forward, and then we'll be coming back here in the fall to go over the rest of the transmission package and eventually get that approved by the end of the year.
Commissioners, questions, comments? You've been busy, Rob.
Yeah, might be able to take a vacation in January.
I was just going to comment, we don't have to worry about Rob, what he's been doing with his time. No, thank you very much.
Okay. And commissioners, any other questions? Gary?
I hate to be the one commenting all the time, and I'm sorry to jump in, but you're doing such a great job, Rob. I just want to let you know that I really appreciate all the hard work, and I'm sure late thank nights you. Putting all this together. And I like the concept of kind of growth pays for growth. That is really sort of what you're modeling here, and I like that. Thank you.
It's good. We started with a template from FERC that really required the interconnection to be paid for by the interconnection customer, and so thankfully we didn't have to tweak that, and so it was easier to, I think, overlay the idea that a large load coming in would be responsible for those costs as well.
Thank you very, very much. Great presentations, both. Yes.
Thank
so
you.
We've come to the end of the scheduled agenda for this morning. I'm looking at the clock, and I also am reminded that early on I mentioned there might be some people calling in that would like to come to the board to talk about an issue and or issues. And I would like, if they're on the line, I would like to remind them. I'm going to call for you to, speak up in a moment. But we, as a board, generally take all input and allow people 3 minutes to share with us what they want to talk about, and then refer that conversation to management. And in all likelihood, there'll be no action taken today. That's our normal process. So with that being said, is there anybody on the line that wishes to address the board? Hearing none, I am going to suggest, Sean, did you have manager items?
Yeah, we have three. Commissioner, and I believe we can get to one or two before lunch. So Why don't we start that?
Okay.
First off is Justin Erickson, Managing Director of District Services, is going to talk about the Rocky Reach Discovery Center landscaping update.
Good morning, Commissioners. Pleasure to be with you this morning. I have an update for you on the hillside landscaping project that we talked about earlier this year. And just by way of refresher, at your February 16th meeting, we presented an update on PPB-funded activities and also brought forth some items for discussion and decision relative to allocation for remaining funding for 2021. The largest project in that group was a request for $400,000 to facilitate entryway and landscaping improvements associated with the Discovery Center and the hill slope immediately to the south. There was some discussion at the meeting about the project and about the cost and if there were other alternatives. And then we followed up with the board again on March 15th and reviewed the plan in additional depth and talked about a reduced scope option. Ultimately, at that meeting, the commissioners gave their you gave your blessing for the $400,000 effort, and staff committed to keeping you updated as we move forward. So that's why I'm back this morning. We have spent the last 5 months working on various designs, looking at ways to stay within the budget, working with our contractor, our GCCM contractor, and meeting with prospective bidders for the work. And unfortunately, we've had many challenges trying to move forward with the project that meets the budget and accomplishes the goals that we set forth. So unfortunately, I don't have good news for you this morning, but wanted to be honest with you and let you know that that's where we're at with this project. The range of costs that we've seen have been anywhere from $600,000 to $900,000. We are seeing challenges with labor and material costs, just as we are with other projects and just as other other organizations are seeing in the valley. So at this time, we would like to, so this clearly is not going to be completed in time for the reopening, and we're unsure if the market will improve in the short term. So what we propose to do is continue to monitor the construction market. We're probably going to explore some additional ways that we might be able to trim some costs from the project and trim some scope. We're looking at meeting with some additional contractors on site and hope to have an update for you perhaps later in the year as part of our regular PPP update in the late fall. Or potentially maybe early 2022, depending upon how the market evolves and if we're able to maybe realize some savings longer term. So, so in the short term, when you visit the Discovery Center as it reopens later this month, just know that that hillside is there and in similar condition to what it has been. We did do some cleanup with our park staff just to get it looking a little bit better, but it certainly does not resemble what we had contemplated with that earlier design. So more to come. Just wanted you to know where we were at before you were out there on site in the near future. Be happy to answer any questions that the commission has.
Thank you, Justin. And sure, that wasn't fun. It wasn't a fun time that you had to make that presentation. So that sometimes there's tough messages. Commissioners, comments?
Okay. Thank you for the update, Justin. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for the update. Thank you.
Okay. Next, we're going to have Steve Wickle talk about the upcoming Chelan-Manson transmission line outage.
Good morning, everybody. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, excellent. Yeah, this is Steve Wickle, transmission engineering manager. Quick background, the Chelan-Manson transmission line fire hardening project is underway, and that is to replace 4 miles of transmission line up in Chelan for fire hardening to help ensure system is ready and can handle a fire. Let's see, we're currently digging the holes for that, and we expect to start erecting the transmission steel poles starting August 30th, provided that we get the materials on time. And during that time, this first phase of actually erecting the poles, the Greater Wenatchee Irrigation District is going to need an 8 to 12 hour outage. Luckily, our own customers, we have backup power supply for them, but for Greater Wenatchee Irrigation District, we do not. Knowing that we had to do this outage, we reached out to Mike Miller, the general manager for GWID, and back in March to let him know. So we've been working with him, and our communications group has been working with our construction manager. We've been back in contact with them, and we have a game plan to let them, all of their customers, know when the outage will be. We're working on a flyer, which is our typical notification process. And in addition to that, we're also going to go ahead and announce it on the Cozy radio address that we do a week before we take the outage. So we just wanted to let you know, because we do unfortunately have to have an outage for those important customers. And we're working with Mike to make that happen as smoothly as possible. So any questions?
That's, I make the assumption, is this outage going to, for the irrigators, going to be September, October, or when will it be probably?
First part of September is what it's looking like.
They probably like it better in October, but that's...
Yeah, we tried. We really did. We were really pushed up against trying to get to sequence this work so that we could construct during fire season and not cause problems, and at the same time be done with the work before heavy winter sets in. And unfortunately, it's just the timing for having to take this outage.
Yeah. Thank you.
You bet.
Commissioners, any questions, comments? Thank you.
Thanks.
We have one more manager item that we're going to have to move to the regular agenda. So if there, do we want to do the commissioner items, fall board workshop? Will we have time for that?
We certainly do have time for that.
Okay.
Commissioners, we have a proposed motion on our agenda today for our fall workshop.
Mr. President.
Yes.
I'd like to propose a motion to set a special meeting on Thursday, September 30, 2021 at 9 a.m. to be held virtually for the purpose of holding a fall board workshop. Virtual meeting information will be posted on the PUD website.
Motion has been made. Is there a second?
Second.
It's been made and seconded to hold a fall workshop. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is carried.
Is that 9 till noon?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other commissioner items at this time? If not, we could, before we recess for lunch, we could act on our consent agenda if we so desired. Would there be a motion to approve the consent agenda?
Mr. Chairman, I move.
Go ahead, Ann. I'm sorry.
Oh,
I think Ann got it out. She moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve the consent agenda. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Any opposed? Hearing none, the motion is carried. And I think we have possibly gone as far as we can go until our afternoon session.
Yeah. If we want, we could do a follow-up on the delegation of action items from the previous board meeting.
Okay. Okay.
So first up, Justin Erickson was supposed to send commissioners the link to the Riverfront Park survey, which he did on August 2nd. Andrew Grissel did follow up with Alan Walker on August 5th on further partnership opportunities with Shalane Douglas and the Community Action Council. And then finally, you heard it here just today, Justin Erickson did provide budgetary details for the $400,000 of additional PPP funds for the Discovery Center egress access improvements. So those were the three items that we have completed, and those were what were on the delegation of action items. Any questions?
Don't believe so.
Okay, well, I think that's what we got for today. We're going to need, do I announce, 90 minutes for, okay, we'll come back at 1. Okay.
And we have one additional manager item at 1 o'clock?
Yes, we will. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then we also have, now, I don't know, do we or do we not have time on for a regular agenda item number 10 right now? Or do we have the right people in the room?
No, we don't.
We don't have the right people. So, okay, well, then in that case, why don't we recess and reconvene at 1 o'clock?
Thank you.
Good afternoon and welcome to our afternoon session of the August 16, 2021 regular commission meeting. We met this morning in study and some business session, and we have a few items left on our agenda to complete for the afternoon, and we'll proceed to do so. First, I'd like to check to find out if there's anybody on the call that wishes to speak to. Well, I guess we have a moment at the end, probably in about 15 minutes, for additional public comment. So if there is somebody on the call, we will open it up for additional public comment at that time. That being said, I believe we completed all the morning session, the consent agenda, and we are now down to agenda item number 10. And John, I will let you take that away.
Thank you, Commissioner Smith. This is a resolution rejecting all bids and declaring that no bids were received for Columbia River Park's Shoreline Erosion Control 2021 bid number 21-13 and authorizing the project be obtained by negotiation. Sam Dilley, Project Manager Principal, will discuss the resolution.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. Sam Dilley here. As mentioned, the resolution is to reject all bids and authorize negotiations for a contract to perform the work. The district received 4 bids for the project on July 29th. We require the bidders to have knowledge and experience in working projects of this nature in the water. We have a number of permits with Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife called the Hydraulic Project Approval. And we have a Corps of Engineers permit that's also been approved by U.S. Fish and Wildlife and National Marine Fisheries. All of these permits are to protect endangered species when we do the work. Therefore, we require the contractors to have a good amount of experience to protect the endangered species. 2 of the contractors submitted bids 15% over the engineer's estimate, and that excludes them from being eligible for the project. 2 of the contractors submitted bids that were within the price range, but they lacked adequate experience. We offered the contractors the opportunity to show us that they had the experience. Neither contractor could. Therefore, we need to reject all bids and negotiate. We expect to be able to negotiate a contract through working with the two lowest bidders and gathering experience from them and gathering information about how they know what they're doing when they work in the water and how their experience working with permit agencies. Based on that, we'd like to move forward with this resolution. Are there any questions?
Commissioners, any questions? I guess, Sam, I've got one, just a little clarification. Your attempt in the negotiation will be to get the two bidders who do not have the experience to show that they do have the experience?
Correct. I should clarify. We asked them some clarifying questions that indicate how they would go about doing the work, make sure that they understand the necessary safety precautions. And while we've asked in the initial bid for their company's experience doing the work, both the low bidders, when they responded to us to clarify, said their companies as a corporation may not have that experience, but the staff that work at those businesses have extensive experience working in the water and in this type of environment. So we're allowing them to give us the resumes of their staff, having done work at other businesses and in their careers, showing that they know how to work in the water and deploy the safety features.
Thank you. That provides a lot greater clarity for me. Commissioners, any other questions? Hearing no questions, is there a motion to approve resolution number 10?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept resolution number 10 as presented.
Is there a second?
I would second that.
Been moved and seconded to approve resolution number 10. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, the same. The motion is carried. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Yep. I believe we have one additional manager item. Is that correct?
That is correct. Debbie Gallagher and Neil Ruzzo will discuss Discovery Center grand opening update.
Easy for you to say.
I only practiced about 100 times.
Good afternoon, commissioners. This is Debbie Gallagher, Visitor Services Manager at Rocky Reach Discovery Center. I want to give you an update on where we're at right now with the grand opening and the soft opening. Countless district staff have worked hard for several years to plan, design, and manage the construction of the new Discovery Center at Rocky Reach. It's been wonderful to see this exciting community treasure transform into a new center and a whole new way to experience that amazing Columbia River. We're looking forward to sharing it with the entire community and visitors that will be coming to Chelan County. However, we've been carefully monitoring the COVID infection rates in our area, and our core project team has determined that we really need to scale back our opening week activities and postpone all of our outside entertainment for safety reasons. We will operate the first Saturday, August 28th, consistent with our normal operating hours, which will be 9:30 to 5, and we're going to limit museum capacity. We will require all of our visitors to register on this particular day since it's our first weekend day open. We're also recommending to continue to hold our scheduled soft opening, our ribbon cutting event for our board and our local leaders in a safe socially distanced way outside the Discovery Center entrance. And that is on Wednesday, August 25th at 9 a.m. This is a huge disappointment to all of us. We were, you know, we've been ramping up for this party for quite some time. Well, for Bob and I, for 6 years. We believe this is the best decision based on what we're seeing with the current COVID cases.
Great. Thanks, Debbie. To communicate the opening week changes, we're going to be issuing a press release and adjusting any radio and print advertising accordingly. One of the primary changes we want to communicate that, as Debbie said, on Saturday, August 28th, we're going to operate from 9:30 to 5, not the 8 to 8 we'd initially planned. And then again, that the outdoor entertainment is postponed. Just to get to a note, we're getting some great interest from local and regional media about the new Discovery Center, and we know this will generate some great attention in the coming weeks and months and over the long term. This last week, for example, we provided tours to reporters from the Wenatchee World, KPQ, and NCW Life. Wanted to reinforce Debbie's statement that we're not canceling a bigger community celebration, but rather postponing it. We want to offer entertainment at a time and date when we can safely celebrate the opening of the Discovery Center with the community. And now we'd look to the commission for any questions or comments. Again, I reinforce with Debbie's statement. This is a disappointment for us all, but we want to do the right thing. And that's our recommendation as the core group organizing this event.
So, Debbie, I think, you know, I'll let the rest of the commissioners speak for themselves, but I think I speak for them all when I say we share your great disappointment. I think we were all looking forward to a great opening. We understand why you have to do it. Safety comes first, and we're in uncharted waters still as it relates to what's going on with COVID. And I really look forward to seeing the new Discovery Center next week. I'd love to see it with, you know, a whole bunch of people there, but we will get there. We will get there. So I know that you and Bob have been putting your heart and soul into this for a lot of years, getting this ready. And, COVID's changed a lot of plans in the last year and a half.
That's right.
Commissioners?
Yeah. Oh, well said, Randy. And Debbie, please convey to your staff that, our disappointment, certainly not in them, but in the circumstances that have made us take a different direction here. Appreciate you guys and all you do. Thank you.
Thank you very much, commissioners. This is tough. You know, it's got to swallow really hard to move through this. But you know what? We're still going to cut that ribbon on Wednesday morning at 9:00. We're going to be there. It's going to be a great ribbon cutting ceremony. And then you know what? We open at noon to the public, and we're going to be open Thursday and Friday, 9:30 to 5. And Saturday morning, by golly, we aren't going to have the big party and the streamers and all of the stuff that we wanted. But we're going to open at 9:30, and we're going to have people there, and we're going to close at 5, and we will be open again on Saturday. So you know what? We can get kicked, but we don't get kicked down. So we're still on both feet, and we're going to move forward for you guys.
Well, thank you for all the effort that you guys have put into this, and we look forward to when we can hold our great grand opening. We really do.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. It's just a postponement, Debbie, and I appreciate your positive attitude. It's been said by Commissioner Bolts and also Commissioner Smith, but I'm going to repeat it. We're very disappointed that due to COVID that this isn't going to happen the way that we had planned. But as you put it, this is only temporary. We're going to come back out of the box strong with a grand opening later on once things calm down. So.
That's right.
We're proud of you guys. You've done a great job out there, and can't wait to get to that day.
Well, you guys mean the world to Bob and I and the rest of the staff. Your support and your enthusiasm, you know, you just back us up on this, and so we really appreciate that. You're going to love it. I'm telling you, you guys are going to love this place. Right when you step into that the first door, that the main door, I can't wait to see the look on your face. So I'm excited.
Cool.
Yeah.
But you'll have to see the look on our face through a mask, I'm guessing.
That's okay. You know what? It's all the eyes, right? When I see your eyes get really big, I'll know that you're very excited.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Debbie. And we look forward to it. We really do.
Thank you.
Is that the last of the manager items?
That is.
We covered briefly commission items this morning, but just the one item, and I didn't give my fellow commissioners any chance for any commission items that they may have. Do Dennis and Gary, I don't think I see Ann on here yet. Maybe she is, but she's not. Okay. Any commissioner items?
No.
I see heads shaking no. So, and this morning we covered the follow-up on delegation of action items from the previous board meeting. Do we have any delegation from today?
We haven't recorded none. Did we miss any, Commissioner Smith?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't recall any.
Got it. Great.
At this time, we're opening the microphone for additional public comment. And if there are any comments, I would remind you that we do record these meetings, and we ask that you state your name and an address for the record and limit your comments to 3 minutes. Are there any additional public comments? Hearing none, are there any other matters that need to come before the commission before we go into an executive session? Hearing none, then we will go into executive session for approximately 90 minutes to discuss with legal counsel agency enforcement actions, litigation, potential litigation to which the district or its board is or is likely to become a party, and or legal risks as authorized by the RCWs, and to consider information regarding the infrastructure and security of computer and telecommunications networks, security and service recovery plans, security risk assessments, and security test results to the extent they identify specific system vulnerabilities pursuant to the RCWs. So we'll move now. We have to dial back in on the executive session line. So I'll see you there.
Thank you.